Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today because we're talking about a topic that's really close to my heart. It takes a real talent to be able to take a complex topic and share it with people in a way that that they understand, it's clear, and also that it's exciting. And not all scientists have that ability, for sure. So it falls to writers sometimes and reporters to bridge that gap. And I'm really glad to have with us today Deb Blum. Deborah Blum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer. She's the author of several books, including the bestseller, which I love, The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. And that's a wonderful book, but we're not going to talk about it today. Oh. We are not. Instead, we are going to talk about the book that she edited, the 2014 edition of The Best American Science and Nature Writing. And Deborah, it's great to see you again. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks, Larry. It's so good to be back on your show.
Oh, I love this book. This is such I started reading this book, and I thought, oh, God, I love this. And I'm picking around. I said, okay, I like that topic. I'll read that. This is outstanding. And then I'd read another one, and this is even better or as good. And it's just such a broad range of science topics.
I had a wonderful time.
You must have had a ball putting this together.
It was so fun. And it's like you give permission to read through some of the best science, obviously the best science writing in the country. I mean, it was hard to figure out what to leave out. Mm-hmm. But I had a wonderful time saying to myself, I've got this sort of wealth of talent, and I get to pick the things that really matter to me here. So you'll see in the book this sort of eclectic mix of stories that I thought were gorgeous or stories that I thought that issue matters so much, it needs to be part of this collection. I want people to hear this.
Yeah.
I loved doing it.
Well, I tell you what, it's a wonderful collection. What do you think are the most important aspects of being a good science communicator?
Well, for me, it's acknowledging that science is part of our everyday life, right? Good science communicators, we're not communicating necessarily with scientists. They already know the material.
Yeah.
Our job is to say to people, I always think of this as, you're already around the campfire or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So the people we want to reach are the people that are not around the campfire having these issues illuminated for them every day and say, come a little closer. This is really important in your life. And so for a writer like me, it's how do I reach someone who decided at some point that science was boring or not important or not part of their everyday life, which it is, and pull them in and see how intrinsic it is to the way they live their own lives and give them tools to navigate their lives by a better understanding of science.
By a better understanding, absolutely. Deborah Blum, our guest today, she is the editor of The Best American Science and Nature Writing for 2014. It's a really wonderful book, and I'm certainly hoping that you'll call in with your questions and comments. Is there a science and nature topic that you wish would be better covered, maybe? Or maybe there's a science communicator who you really enjoy reading. Would love to hear about that as well. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions or your comments there. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. And such a broad range of things in this. And so many I really, really loved. And I'm just going to skip to the one I think I loved the most, which was O-rings.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Johnson's story, which looks at what you call our daredevil love of exploration and technology. And she connects some pretty surprising things in that piece.
I love that story. I mean, for one thing, it's just beautifully told. And
yes.
It pulls you right into these moments where people are living their lives one step away from death. Right.
Yeah.
And then while she's got you there and she's writing from the perspective of Antarctic exploration, she says, but wait a minute, Right. One, why do we want to do this? Why do we do something? Mm-hmm. And then how do we undermine our own explorations through failures of technology? And the most amazing way, she connects, you know, very early catastrophic explorations down in the Antarctic with the complete catastrophic failure of the space
Challenger.
Yeah, when you're just, you have this head spinning moment where you go, I never knew you could connect those dots. That's the most amazing thing. And I love that when a story teller connects dots for you like that.
Oh, it was absolutely fascinating how O-rings were a part of both of those. Of course, I think most of us probably knew the O-rings connected with the Challenger disaster.
There was that famous moment, and she references it, when the late, great Richard Feynman took the same plastic-ish material that these O-rings, which were sealers, they served to seal the engines on the Challenger, and stuck one of them in a glass of ice water, and you watched it become brittle. And it was like, oops.
Yeah.
And she does that, but then she takes you way back to very early oxygen canisters and says, guess what? It's just brilliant.
Yeah, it is fantastic. Vince in Fond du Lac has something for us, so let's go there. Vince, hi, thank you for calling.
I farm in Fond du Lac County, and I put in a small acreage of corn each year, and this year, for the first time, we planted Roundup Ready corn, and that's genetically modified or altered or whatever, and I listened to talk radio when I work, and I find a lot of people are very scared of this. They call it Frankencorn. I have nieces and nephews that are in high school and college, and oh, you've planted Frankencorn. Well, it looks the same as any other corn. And I found the farmers don't even use the word genetically modified. They just call it Roundup Ready or rootworm resistant. Tell the people, what's the real truth about this? How does it happen? I'm a little bit in the dark myself. I just pick up what I read in the seed catalogs. I'll kind of hang up and listen.
Well, Vince, I'm really glad you called in, and I hope you get a copy of this book, and particularly the article, A Race to Save the Orange, I believe, wasn't it? By
Amy Harmon.
By Amy Harmon, yeah. And it's... Well, describe that piece. Talk about that piece for a minute, Deborah.
So Amy Harmon is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer at the New York Times, and she's been taking on this exact issue. How do we look rationally at genetically modified crops? She did a wonderful piece also that's not my book, about Hawaii and some of the work there with sugar and pineapple. But this is a really fascinating story because it's called A Race to Save the Orange. It looks at the fact that there's a bacterial infection of citrus crops, citrus greening, for which there is no remedy.
Yeah.
And the only way you could possibly save the American citrus crop is to genetically modify some resistance into these. And so do we do it? Do we let them just get blasted out if this is our only option? And the story is this wonderful narrative in which he follows a citrus grower who's trying to save his oranges, who goes into this political pitfall. And it also makes the point that I think you're getting at, which is that we need more rational education about what genetically modified crops are, because sometimes they will save us and they will save our lives.
Yeah.
And sometimes large commercial entities have done things with genetic modification that we don't all admire. We need to acknowledge that, too. But within there's a story of science that tells us that, for instance, the corn you're growing is not particularly dangerous, right? And so people need to actually get a much better understanding of this. And I actually do recommend Amy's work. She's amazing on this subject.
It was an excellent piece on it. And just to cut to it a little bit, they were using something from a spinach plant.
That's right.
They're modifying something from a spinach plant to insert into the orange.
So they weren't ginning up some, Dr. Franken-ish, synthetic gene. They were taking a natural gene that conferred resistance, and a lot of people don't understand that. Nature genetically modifies, right? What's evolution? Mm-hmm. Evolution is genetic modification. We can speed the process scientifically, and we can focus it, but genetic modification is not something we invented. Right. I think that needs to be better understood.
Yeah. And sometimes with new things, an engineer was telling me once about the problems that the pushback from people when silos were developed.
Oh, really?
Because of the fermenting of corn was felt to modify the corn to such an extent that it would be dangerous for animals or people.
That's a good point, and the issue also reminds us that we need to do a better job of genetic education, period. You've probably seen those surveys that show that people think that there are only genes in genetically modified food, right, which is all food. Every time you bite an organic apple, there's a mouthful of genes because all living cells have genes in them. It's like we need to do as science writers, too, let's get that message out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Drew in Brooklyn, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, Larry and guest. Am I on?
Yes, you are. What's on your mind?
Well, you talk about science writing. I immediately think of John McPhee. And I'm wondering how your guest feels about Mr. McPhee whether he appears on her radar. I happen to think John McPhee has brought to life so many different aspects of one of my favorite sciences, which is probably geology, other things such as the environment, the Delaware River. I just wanted to ask, and thanks for the show.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, I've got a feeling that you're going to like John McPhee.
John McPhee continues to have an enormous, what I think of as a cult following among science writers. And if you're not familiar with him, he's probably most famous as a science writer who started his career at The New Yorker.
Yeah.
Could write these unbelievably complicated, gorgeous, long pieces about anything. He wrote almost 20,000 words, famously, on oranges.
Yeah.
And then went on to write books, including these gorgeous geology books. Basin and Range stands out. He took a look at Alaska, again, looking at geology. I'm hoping that we continue to admire John McPhee. Early on, when I became an environment writer, I was an environment writer. I got my degree in that here at the University of Wisconsin. He was my model. I wanted to be John McPhee.
Yeah.
And I still teach him in my writing classes because of the incredibly intricate way he can organize and tell a story. And because he had a gift for, it's the Mark Twain thing,
yep.
Right? Not any word, but the word,
right?
Yeah. John McPhee always hit the word.
Yeah, his writing on Alaska was, I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
It was
yeah.
wonderful. I tell you what, Deborah Bloom is wonderful, too, and an absolutely par excellence writer and editor as well. And the book we're talking about with her is the 2014, The Best American Science and Nature Writing of 2014. Join in with your questions or comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure you're enjoying our conversation today with Deborah Blum. Deb has a wonderful book, and it is a bestseller, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was just in the New York Times. They did the top 20 selling science books, and this was on the list. I was so excited.
I think it's wonderful that it's there. Rick in near Ironwood, Michigan, has something for us. Rick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Great show. Great guest. Really loving it. This is regarding a book called Studying Wisconsin and by Martha Berglund and Paul Hayes. And it's the story of Increase Lapham in the 1800s. I think you've had her on your show before, but he lived from 1811 to 1875. Geologist.
Extraordinary geologist.
Extraordinary, and built was involved with the building of the Erie Canal and many different things. And his work with the mounds preserving the effigy mounds is phenomenal, and it's inspiring us up here. I'm working, the book is inspiring me in a lot of ways, but I work in invasive species control and trying to come up with organic methods so I don't have to use chemicals. But in my work, I get a chance to go out and get onto these ancient lands, and now we're preserving some mine sites up here near Ironwood and trying to capture that piece of history. And so I want to follow the same kind of thinking that he did as he studied and worked his way across the state. And the book is just so inspiring for that. It just really gets you going.
Thank you so much for calling. And, you know, and that's kind of what you hope, isn't it?
Yes. You want someone to read a story of science or a story of a scientist and say, that matters in my life and that can inspire me to make a change.
And it certainly has done so in this case of our caller.
Yeah, that's really actually makes me want to read the book, which I haven't yet.
Steve in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you very much. I'd like to know, how do we engage our legislators who will not listen to our concerns regarding climate change? I had a chance to talk to my congressman, and I made the mistake of introducing myself as a retired science teacher. And when I tried to make a point regarding climate change, I said, I think you and I can agree. And he interrupted me and screamed at me and said, you and I will never agree on anything. And that was the end of the conversation. And how do we approach these people?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's addressed, as a matter of fact, in one of the pieces, Kate Shepard's piece, Underwater, I think was the title of it, which looks at climate change and coastal development.
Right. It's very frustrating, and it's actually a question that we talk about a lot as science writers. I mean, and we'll almost beat ourselves up. Could we have told these stories better? Why doesn't everyone believe that climate change is happening when it so obviously is? Why doesn't everyone recognize the sort of man-made factors in that? Some of it, frankly, is that, you know, the arguments are sometimes ideological. So that you have to accept that you're never going to be able to reach people who just don't want to hear the evidence because they are stuck in a sort of an ideological loop. But Larry's right. One of the pieces I particularly liked in this book, which was Kate Shepard's piece, is a method that I think we're trying to do more and more as science communicators, and that is rather address the huge issue of a changing planet. Address the very specifics of change in your backyard, right? So that you just are making a single case and saying, watch this change. So, for instance, we know in Wisconsin, and one of my students did a story about this, that the maple syrup season is changing. Right. Maple trees need a certain amount of super cold. We're not getting that in the way we used to. I had my student interview a lot of people who were working with maple syrup, and they were talking about the effect on the industry. And so it's when we go down to the specifics that I think we actually do have a chance. And I think this book illustrates that in some interesting ways.
Yeah, I think it does, too. And if you, as she points out in her book, this whole business of climate change, the coastal development, we are spending as a nation $2 billion a week on covering the expenses associated with the flooding.
That's right.
That has occurred along our coastlines.
So that
$2 billion a week.
We're subsidizing people's vacation homes all around the country, right? And we actually do need to come up with a realistic policy. This is an expensive hobby to be supporting as taxpayers.
So thank you. Everything is local, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. I want to give you a chance to join in, too, as you listen in, and maybe you want to chime in on one of the topics that we're talking about today, or maybe talk about science writing or how to do it. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. I had a question. And actually, My sister is working on, she was taking her hand at writing. So she's taking up writing, like as many people are doing. And she has a topic, and I've talked to her like 15 minutes before the show today, and she said, oh, please ask. She said, I have 50 pages of materials, disparate materials on a topic. Mm-hmm. Where do I start? How do I put this together? And I said, well, that's a long conversation. We teach long courses on this, but I'll ask Deborah and see what she's got to say.
I think the universal writer question, right? Where do I start this story? Well, one of the things you have to remember about any story is that it's the story, a good story is one that you would tell someone else, right? Mm-hmm. You see this in a lot of news. What was unusual about that? That's how I start my story. Mm-hmm. So when you're starting any story, the beginning of your story is basically a seduction, right? Mm-hmm. And so what you want to do is have them read down to why I'm telling you this story. So start the story with the thing that you think is most repeatable. I'll tell my brother Larry this, right? This is really cool stuff. And once you've started there, where you're essentially seducing your reader into the story, then you figure out how to build your way to the end. But it begins with seduction.
That's very, very well put. And I know she's listening. So Meredith, pay attention. By the way, Judith posted a link on our Facebook page to the show that I did with the authors of Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham. And we did that last summer. So for people who did not hear it and maybe were interested because of hearing about Increase Lapham, want to put it up with, there it is, right on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can join in, too. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or, again, post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. One of the topics, and I try to be even-handed and so forth in my discussions with people, but there's one that I really kind of never am even-handed about, and that has to do with vaccinations. I have an 11-year-old daughter, and I would prefer that she goes to a school where every student has their measles vaccination, for example. And you highlight Seth Mnookin's very timely piece on the public health cost of measles.
Yeah, I feel incredibly brilliant that when I was picking these last year, I picked measles and vaccination, and I don't feel even-handed about that either. I feel like standing on street corners saying, do we really want to go back to the Middle Ages, right? Isn't there a reason why we recognize that vaccines are one of the great public health breakthroughs? And so Seth wrote a book earlier called The Panic Virus, looking at the rise of the anti-vaccine movement. He's been really targeted by the extreme elements in that movie. You'd be surprised at how extreme some of these anti-vax people are. So he's had death threats against himself and his family, and people just furious that he would question their beliefs. He's never quit actually ringing this bell. But in this particular piece, he makes a point that I think all of us need to realize, which is that there's two points. One is these anti-vaxxers are very expensive to the rest of us, because when we get an outbreak, it costs tens and tens and thousands of public health dollars to deal with it and confine it and do all the tests and try to protect everyone else, and we pay for that, not them. There's actually been recent discussions over whether there should be an anti-vax tax. You don't want your kids vaccinated, you have to pay an extra tax because you're going to cost the rest of it so much. And the other point he makes, and I think it's something that we forget, is this is not a personal decision. This is not just, well, it's just about me and I, feel queasy about whatever. This is about the fact that vaccines, one of the great successes of vaccines is herd immunity, Right. A vaccine needs a host. And when you vaccinate a community, the reason you control an outbreak is that vaccine cannot travel far enough to sustain, I mean, the virus cannot travel far enough to sustain itself. Well, measles, you only need to have about 6% of the population unvaccinated to give measles a pathway. I mean, it's the most infectious microbe known. And there are parts of California where they're on the borderline for herd immunity with polio. And that is a really scary thought. So just remember that people are making decisions about our health when they're making these decisions.
Yeah. Well, we have callers online. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Joan and Rudolph. Joan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks. I'm wondering, how do you address when scientists get it wrong? For example, DDT was said to be good for us. And we know where that went. And now the new dietary concerns about cholesterol are appearing to be incorrect. I generally agree with the scientific things, but there are areas where scientists don't fully investigate the secondary, tertiary effects and how changing one aspect of a specific piece of the environment without really understanding how it
ripples up to the other things, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Good point, Joan. Thanks for calling. What do you think, Deb?
I think she's absolutely right. We see this throughout our scientific history. I'm so glad you brought it up because, in fact, one of the points I made in the introduction to the book, DDT is a great example of what you're talking about. And we've seen throughout the history of science technology a kind of, wow, this is the best thing ever without really understanding its effects. In the introduction to my own, the introduction I wrote to this collection, I actually wrote about going out to the Nevada test range where we used to do above ground nuclear testing and standing in a radioactive hotspot and having my photographer from the newspaper set off the radiation alarms. I laughed because it wasn't me, when we left and just made the point that at that time, everyone thought nuclear bombs, there were no worries about nuclear radiation. Well, there were some, but people didn't appreciate that. They didn't follow those chains. And now we see all of these different after effects of understanding what the nuclear bomb is and what radiation is. So you see this over and over and over in our history. I really think that it's important to add that into the way we look about science. So, to understand that science is people trying to understand the world around us. That's what it is. It's not like some unique, different, smarter species. It's us, right? Mm-hmm. Trained to understand an avenue of inquiry and following that avenue of inquiry. And in that sense, the kind of thing you're talking about means that we're going to make human errors. And we're going to make human errors about the consequences, and we're not always going to follow them well enough. And that's why we need to learn from past mistakes. Mm-hmm. We need to not lose our history, even in something like vaccines. And we need to say, let's not keep repeating these mistakes, right? When we introduce a new, next best pesticide or the world's best pharmaceutical or some super development, let's remember not that we've made these mistakes before and let's build into the system a better kind of watchdog effect. So
yeah,
I think that's really
points.
Important.
Yeah, and thanks again for calling, Joan. Appreciate your call. I want to give Mike a chance to join in from Madison. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning. Good morning to your guests. You talked about the anti-vaxxers. We tried, as my wife and I, to get my children vaccines without the mercury component in it. We were not anti-vaccine. We were anti the mercury. I can't believe that we as a society can put men on the moon. We can do all these wonderful technological things, genetically modified foods, but we can't create a vaccine that doesn't have the mercury component in it. I can't believe they couldn't find another product to put in there to keep the vaccines being safe. So to just say that vaxxers are completely anti-vaccines is missing the point here. It's the mercury component. Take the mercury out, and I'm sure half of those people would be all on board with these vaccines. Mm-hmm. Continue to have the mercury included in these vaccines. And of course, people have been brought up for decades learning mercury is dangerous, it's poisonous. Why is it in the vaccine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me address that because that's a—I mean, that certainly was what we think of as the origin of the modern anti-vax movement, which was that there was a study out of England which suggested there was a link between mercury in vaccines and brain damage. That study, of course, has been fully discredited. The guy was disbarred from the medical society in England because he made up those findings, and so there have been multiple studies since that show that, in fact, the formula of mercury that is sometimes used as a preservative in vaccines. Mercury has antibacterial action, so it's a long-standing preservative. If you're my generation, it used to be in an antibiotic called Mercurochrome. That mercury in the tiny, tiny amount that it's in there really doesn't cause anything. But we haven't been able to shake that mercury backstory on vaccines. Frankly, if I was worried about mercury exposure, I wouldn't eat tuna fish. You and your kids are going to get a lot more mercury from tuna fish than you're ever going to get from a vaccine. So I'd love to see some better science. I'm not against having better, and I think in some vaccines we have gotten the mercury out.
Yeah,
I'm not against
it is.
Many of them. That's an old-time preservative. And I think the new generation vaccines don't have that so much. So we just need to do a better job of getting all of that information out, the discredited research, the issues with mercury that we really should worry about, and the new generation of vaccines that don't contain that.
And thanks very much for calling, Mike. I want to give Cheryl in Owen a chance to join in. Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking my call. I am concerned about the genetic alteration of food. So food is a fundamental, not an option for us, but very much overlooked when it comes to genetic modification. When Roundup Ready is planted, the advertising for that chemical is that it dissipates in the soil, but it doesn't, because there has been tests that show that it is carried over. We have to find follow the dollar trail and what the profit motive is. When corn is altered to include BT, which is Bacillus thuringiensis, that kills caterpillars, it is not an isolated caterpillar that it kills. It's a broad kind of killer.
All right, thank you for calling. I want to give Deborah a chance to join in. And Cheryl, I really hope you will get a copy of this book and take a look at the piece we were talking about earlier, which was A Race to Save the Orange. Not that it's totally pro-genetically modified foods by any stretch of the imagination, but well, go ahead.
I mean, I think it's reasonable to say we need to pay very close attention to the role of any pesticide or genetically modified material in the environment. You know, we need to worry about pollinators, although I think there's other more dangerous issues like the nicotinoid pesticides with those. A lot of our discussion about genetically modified crops has tended to be focused on companies like Monsanto that have specifically engineered crops in a way that they are resistant to certain herbicides like Roundup, so that you can use, and that allows greater farming efficiency. And you're right that there are environmental issues with Roundup. However, if you go and you look especially in country, and not in this country so much, but in other countries, you see a huge drop-off in pesticide poisoning of wildlife because, indeed, you use less pesticide with some of these genetically modified crops. What I really think we need to do is get the science out there in a way that separates it from the pesticide issue, separates it from the Monsanto issue. I'm not a huge fan of everything Monsanto has done either.
No.
And say, but where are the places that this is actually going to be of benefit? Where are the places where we need to use this, and how do we best study those instances so we do them safely and well and avoid what the earlier caller called the ripple effect. All of that goes into responsible management of genetic modification.
Absolutely. And I really enjoyed reading the piece that we were talking about, the chapter from one chapter from your book. And we've covered a few areas, but there are so many other areas that you cover in the book. Talk about so many publications, the materials from so many publications.
That was important to me. I wanted a wide variety of voices, right? There's small newspapers in Alaska. There's a new crop of online publications like Nautilus.
Yeah.
There's big well-known magazines like National Geographic. And then there's a really nice gender mix, frankly. You know, this is the first book in this series' history that's half male, half female in terms of the authorship. And that was important to me, too, because science writing is split about that way. And I wanted to acknowledge everyone's good work. So one of my quick favorite stories is this fabulous piece on leprosy.
Yes.
And in which you think, how could a piece on leprosy be this beautiful and this empathetic about who we are? And she pulled this. Rebecca Solnit just writes a piece where it's not like you want to go to a leper's colony, but you're just blown away by the kindness and the humanity that surrounds that story.
Well, it's a fascinating, fascinating piece for sure. And I don't know if I'd call it. Well, it's one of my. Frankly, they're all my favorites.
Yeah.
That's got to be. I'm sure you felt the same way as you looked.
If you read something that makes you see the world differently,
which
is the other great goal of a good writer, let me turn the world sideways for you for a minute, right? Let me make you look at it this way. Then that's a favorite piece, and I'm so proud of the number of stories that in this book that I think will make you see the world differently.
Yeah, it's just a great book, Deborah. Thank you so much for coming by to talk with us about it. As we've learned, I mean, there's always some controversy about these topics, and that's why I think really, if no matter where you stand on some of these issues, I really think it's important and well worthwhile to read about how these authors have, as you say, kind of turned things a little sideways,
yes,
and let you look at it in a new way. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you so much for letting me come on.
Oh, I loved it. I love talking with you. She's always a great guest. Deborah Blum, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, the author of several books, The Poisoner's Handbook, one of my favorites. She's a professor at UW-Madison, edited the 2014 edition of The Best American Science and Nature Writing, and I'm just absolutely convinced you're going to enjoy that book. Coming up, we're gonna turn the tables a little bit, talking about another book, and this one focuses on some plants that we don't always like to see. Weeds. There are weeds, a lot of weeds in North America, and I tell you what, there's a new book out that talks about weeds in a really fun way. Richard Dickinson, coming up next, our guest on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.